The Lollipop Guild only listens to WGXC Accra 90.7 FM.
Listen to music and voices. Listen to art and discussion. Listen to work and play. Listen to eat and drink. Listen to up and down. Listen to noise and fun. Listen to purple and green. Listen to pink and blue. Listen to a heart rainbow. Listen to wizards and witches. Listen to jazz play. Listen to dogs and mice. Listen to Rome and Italy. Listen to Mars and Venus. Listen to the planet. Listen to the planet. Listen to ladies and dumplings. Listen to books. Listen to teeth and trunks. Listen to bath time and nap time. Listen to Kaizen and Violet. Listen to Stars and Stripes. Listen to Texas and listen to bells and waterfalls. Listen to churches and steeple. Dance and sing and listen and bells. Listen to making things, stripes and zigzags. Listen to clouds and leaves, bike riding and zigzagging. No, listen to bike riding and curving. Listen to the radio going on and on. Listen to the radio going on and on. Listen to the radio, WGXC.
Biblioteca Pública de Catskill. Nos gusta mucho tener programas del equipo de WGXC viniendo de la biblioteca desde el cuarto Carnegie. Para información en cómo utilizar el espacio para una reunión suya, llame por favor 518-943-4230.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Scribner's Catskill Lodge, a 38-room boutique hotel located in Hunter, offering a seasonal outdoor pool, weekend wellness programming, and nightly s'mores around the fire pits. Located at 13 Scribner Hollow Road, across the street from Hunter Mountain, 8 miles from the forest trails in Catskill Park, and 22 miles from the town of Woodstock. Scribner's is also home to the Prospect Restaurant and Bar, serving modern fare. Information at 518-628-5130 or at www.scribnerslodge.com.
I'll have some clam chowder followed by beefsteak on rye, pumpkin pie with cream and coffee. I want a green salad on the side. Don't forget the french fries, pizza pie, garlic and anchovy.
Good afternoon and welcome to Eating It in the Hudson Valley. I'm your host, Phyllis Segura. Today we have a mix-up of different people, and we were going to have Chef Joe Landa, the chef owner of Rive Gauche Bistro in Athens, to be on the show, but he got ill. So we'll have to have him here another time. However, we do have Chef Christine Moss of the Garden Cafe in Woodstock. Welcome.
Thank you.
And plus Peter Wilson, who will review the book Bountiful Empire, A History of the Ottoman Cuisine by Priscilla May Ishin.
Ishin.
Okay. Chef, I'll tell you a little bit about Chef Moss. I don't know how many of you have been to the Garden Cafe in Woodstock, but it's a very crowded place, and it's an all-vegan cafe. And she has different offerings like tofu satay with peanut sauce, black bean quesadillas, red lentil vegetable enchiladas, and a house-made focaccia and cornbread, but she'll tell us more. She was originally an anthropology and studio art major and is not formally trained, and neither was Chef Landa. So we were going to have two not formally trained chefs here today, which is fine. I'm also a chef, but not formally trained. Well, I'm partially formally trained. And Christine studied art, poetry, and painting as well. And she's familiar with foraging and growing food and catering. And she arrived in Woodstock with two children, got a job at the Garden Cafe doing salads and desserts for years, and then became the sous chef there. Or one of them, or just...
The sous chef. I worked under Pam Brown.
And in 2015, you became the head chef.
Yes.
She's also the market manager at the Saugerties Farmers Market on Saturdays, and she'll tell us about that. And there is a moment when Desiree Carr is going to pop in, to the studio here at the Catskill Library. And she's the manager at the Catskill Farmers Market. So she's going to tell us a little bit about that, but we'll wait till she gets here. Christine, what are you cooking?
So many things. Today, for example, I'm going to share a recipe with you. Something that I cooked this morning is a stewed mushroom gravy. Mm-hmm. And it's really a very versatile and fun dish to cook because it's something that you can throw it on top of mashed potatoes or stuff it into a taco as taco filling. You can throw it over rice. You can put it on top of some grilled tofu. It's a really delicious and versatile thing to
eat.
Well,
what makes it different in the vegan world? Is the thickener a little bit different? Were you using different things, the oil?
I use as much organic and fresh and locally found ingredients as possible. Mm-hmm. For a thickener, I tend to use arrowroot mm-hmm. instead of flour because it'll be gluten-free that way. We have a lot of dietary restrictions that come into the restaurant. Mm-hmm. And so I want to be aware and considerate of people's needs of what they mm-hmm. need to eat.
What kind of mushrooms does this have?
Well, this morning I...
We'll do the recipe a little bit later.
Oh, okay, sure. The one I made this morning has yellow oyster mushrooms, mm-hmm. and they were locally grown, actually, in my backyard. I found them in one of the trees that are back there. Mm-hmm. But this is something that I do at the restaurant with shiitake mushrooms, and mm-hmm. I also do it with portobello mushrooms.
Right.
So it's a really versatile recipe.
Mm, cool. And here is... Do I say your name right? Desiree?
Desiree, yes.
Desiree Carr.
Hello.
You can put the headphones on if you like. And we're going to let Desiree pop in here and tell us a little bit because she was a last-minute call. Not that we didn't want her, but we had a full show, but then we had an empty show. So tell us about the Catskill Market. You know that this is Christine Moss and this is Peter Wilson.
Hi.
Christine is also the market manager at the Sargides Market, so maybe later the two of you want
to
have
a
conversation.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell us about the Catskill Market, when it is, and what you'd like to promote, really.
The market.
Okay.
The market itself. We are down at Dutchman's Landing Park, not the Point. It's Dutchman's Landing Park, which is 10 Main Street, right in the village of Catskill, right on the water. We are Friday nights from 4 to 7 p.m. We have music, entertainers coming every Friday. We have food trucks. Is that better? I'm so new to this. Plus, we have all of our wonderful vendors that are there.
What does that mean, wonderful vendors?
Wonderful vendors. Oh, my goodness. We have, we have C&B Cafe.
What is that? What's that?
They are a soon-to-be farm-to-table cafe up in Caro. Mm-hmm. They have fresh-made bread, mm-hmm. and they actually just started working with Bulich's Creekside Farm for our produce. Mm-hmm. So they're our produce vendor currently. In cahoots with Bulich's. We have Crosstown Maple. They have all of our maple products, most of our maple products, excuse me. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say all of. A lot of farms have a little bit of everything, but they're a big maple people. They have maple syrups, obviously, and then they have candies and maple syrup, cotton candy, barbecue sauces, rubs, things like that. Mm-hmm. We have Lime Kiln Farm, which has cow and goat cheeses. We have Rock and Raw, which also has many cheeses and pesto. We have Jenny's Street Eats is actually our current food truck there at the market. We have Sleepy Bear LLC. They actually come in from pretty far away. They have soaps, beeswax candles. They also have honey and maple syrup as well. But they also do things like natural deodorants and chapsticks and beard balms and things like that. We have Pine Tree Crafts, which is a couple from the area that make beautiful wooden crafts for the home. Things like dog dish elevated bowls and decorations for your garden and for in your house. Let's see, I'm trying to go around the circle. I probably should have wrote it all down.
But what about the foods? Like, you know, what do you think is special this time of the year that might be at the market on Friday?
Let's see. Last week when they came, they had a lot of zucchini, eggplant, tomatoes are really big right now. And the great thing, especially with C&B, is they also make sandwiches every week, and they use the products from our other vendors. They use cheese from Limekiln. A lot of times they'll have eggs and or meat from Half Pint Farms. Excuse me. That was the one that I also forgot to mention was Half Pint Farm as well. They are our meat vendor. They have, beef and chicken and eggs. She also does a lot of baked goods, brownies and fudges and pies and things like that. She also has some of her own crafts, but definitely the meat and the eggs are the showcase for her. And so, yes, there's definitely, it's, we're trying to make it less of an errand and more of an event. So you come out.
So people can actually come in and have a sandwich and sit by the park. And
oh, we
and
would prefer
there.
It, of course. Oh, absolutely. Okay, there's like, great. Like I said, we have musicians every week, all different kinds of music. We have blues and rock. We have a local musician that plays the singing saw. She's actually coming up again soon.
Do you remember who's coming this Friday?
This Friday, we actually have Lou Watterson. He's one of our local musicians, blues kind of stuff. It's he creates like the most chill atmosphere when he's there. It's so great.
Oh, good.
And we've created it right at the park by the gazebo. So he sets up in the gazebo. Well, all of our performers set up in the gazebo, and we set up the picnic tables around it. And all of our vendors are set up in a semicircle around it as well. So you come, you shop a little, you have something to eat, you hang out and watch, listen to some music. It's an evening. It's not just a hurry up and get to the market and get home.
Okay, good. I'm so glad you had an opportunity to stop by.
Thank you for letting me stop in.
You're welcome to sit in and just join us. Or if you need to leave, you're welcome to do that too.
No, I have a few minutes. If you don't mind me here.
Yeah, we're going to get back to our...
Yes, that'd be great.
Our planned programming, okay. You should say. No, not yet, Peter. Peter, I'm very anxious to hear what Peter has to say about this book, but I have to go through my chef things first, and, you know, Peter, just, you know, just hang in and enjoy it, you know. We're very lucky to have Peter with us here today, and I'm going to tell you about Peter right now, just so you're going to hang in and you're going to wait. Peter Lamborn Wilson is an author who has written, edited, and translated over 60 books. His most recent book is collected poetry called Lucky Shadows, and a second, also recently published, called Vanished Signs. Both these and his other writings can be found on Amazon. Peter also has had a long-running radio show on WBAI called the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusades. And Peter will explain to us why it is that I asked him to review the particular book about the cuisine of the Ottoman Empire in a little while. And then he'll tell us about the book. Okay? So hang in. It'll be a treat to hear Peter Wilson. He's a very special guest for us here today. I do want to take a moment and recognize that Chef Joel Robuchon died last week, and he began adding vegetarian options to his menu at L'Atelier in New York. He was, of course, very famous for his mashed potato puree, and mostly for the technique and the massive quantity of butter that was employed in this particular dish. But I'm just going to take a moment and read his vegetarian menu, and I want to get some feedback from Christine. What do you think of it? It's not a vegan menu, but it's this, and a very haute cuisine. Chilled cherry and tomato velouté, whipped ricotta, pistachio. Then the second one is beets. I have a typo here. I have to go with that. Apple avocado duo with green mustard sorbet. An eggplant confit with fine seasonings, we don't know what that is, and vegetable curry. Roasted baby artichokes, chickpea emulsion, and a saffron-flavored risotto with pimentos and cauliflower couscous. Lychee sorbet, raspberry coulis, and lemon poppy foam. For some of our listeners, I might take a moment and define some of those terms. A velouté is a rich white sauce thickened with cream and egg yolks. And a coulis is a thin fruit or vegetable puree used as a sauce. I wonder, how could we get a vegan velouté? Have you ever tried to do that, Christine?
Yes, there are certain things you can use to make a sauce very light and fluffy and creamy. One of the ingredients that I like to use are cashews. They're very versatile, and you would want to soak them first, ideally overnight in the refrigerator, and drain off the water after it's been soaking. And you could use the cashews, again, add a little water after that to blend it up in the blender, and it becomes very thick and creamy and foamy all by itself. And to that, you can add a little bit of salt. One of the vegan secret ingredients are nutritional yeast. It has a very kind of a pungent, almost a Parmesan type of feel to it and
it's
flavor.
It's an acquired taste, too.
It is. Well, don't go heavy with it either. Just a lot of ingredients, if they're new to you, just add a little bit in here and there to what you normally eat. And that's one way of learning new foods and expanding.
Mm-hmm. So you use that as a sauce?
I would use that as a base for a sauce, yes.
Do you add anything to it?
Oh, the nutritional yeast. You can add roasted garlic, fresh pepper. You can add herbs to it. Throw it in the blender with fresh thyme or oregano. And it's very fragrant. And it's a nice carrier for different herbs, or even you can use it with roasted red peppers. Throw that in, mix it together. It'd be delicious.
Here, he mentioned a chickpea emulsion. Do you ever do anything like that?
It's in a similar way. It's I don't do so much the emulsion type of cooking, but if you cook, we use all dried chickpeas, organic, and I pressure cook them so that they're ready rather quickly rather than waiting overnight for the restaurant. And if you take like maybe a cup or two of those into the blender while they're still warm, with a little bit of vegetable stock, blend that up, it also becomes a very creamy, delicious type of sauce. You
so
can add a little bit.
It's warm and the vegetable stock gives it more flavor. Great.
Yes.
The Garden Cafe is very popular.
Thank you, yes.
What are some of the dishes that people really like, that they order all the time?
Oh, we cannot make enough of the vegetable lasagna. That is something that we are making day in, day out. And it's gluten-free. It's all vegetables. It's layers of zucchini, which this is probably the best time of year.
So you're substituting the pasta with the zucchini?
Zucchini, thinly sliced zucchini, yellow squash, fresh spinach, red peppers, and cashew ricotta cheese, which is kind of the cashew sauce that I spoke about at the beginning.
Well, the last show was about vegan cheeses. I don't know if you had an opportunity to listen to it, but we went through a
fantastic
lot of that.
Fantastic. Okay, so hopefully people kept their notes and you can
well,
use
they just
that.
Well, they can just go and buy it.
They can come and eat here, too.
People do,
So that's one thing. Another thing that we can't seem to keep in the restaurant is the chocolate mousse for dessert. And it's soy-free. It's all coconut milk and a very dark Belgian chocolate espresso. And it's just whipped up magically.
Peter, what do you think about vegan cuisine?
I have trouble with it, but it's because of dietary restrictions that I can't eat beans, for example. So that really cuts out a lot of what you guys do. I used to live right next to your restaurant.
Oh, really?
And you know, I tried to eat there because it's got the nice garden and everything. But I can't eat tomatoes. Can't eat avocados.
Oh, neither can I.
Can't eat beans. So, you know, it's dreadful, but...
Well, not entirely dreadful. You should still come in and give it a chance because we
work
with...
I want to hear the
with...
mushroom gravy recipe. That sounds like something I could
absolutely
eat.
Absolutely. Yeah,
well,
you can leave out the tomato paste.
Oh, tomato paste.
You can leave that out.
There's always something.
Yeah, why don't you give us the recipe for the mushroom gravy?
Okay, so for the mushroom gravy, it's a nice, quick, easy thing to make because it's a one dish... recipe, and into your baking pan you want to drizzle about 2 or 3 tablespoons of olive oil, and to that you're going to add one Spanish onion, and one red bell pepper. Cut it very thinly into strips and separate it out into the olive oil in the pan. And then to that, you're going to have about 1 pound of mushrooms. That's like a nice size or quantity to buy for maybe two or three people.
So you've got onion and red pepper in there already.
Yes.
I mean, red bell pepper.
Red bell pepper.
I would never do that.
Oh, really?
I wouldn't put... No, because the taste of the red bell pepper and the mushrooms to me don't mix. But it's your dish and people like it, so go ahead.
And to that, the mushrooms, this works either with shiitake mushrooms, oyster mushrooms, or portobellos are very good flavors that work with these ingredients.
Can you mix them?
You could mix them. I would... The oyster mushrooms tend to cook a lot faster than the portobello or the shiitake, so I wouldn't mix those two together. But if you wanted to do shiitake and portobellos together, that's a nice combination as well. And you want to remove the stems and also slice the mushrooms into thin strips and add in also... I like a lot of garlic, so I would probably add in like 4 or 5 cloves of smashed garlic. But you may want to do 1 or 2. And then, so everything's in your pan, and to that, you're going to sprinkle in 1 teaspoon of cumin, a generous shake of some dried thyme, and some freshly ground black pepper.
But if you have fresh thyme, you can use it?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, good.
Oh, definitely. Or you can even use, if you've dried your thyme yourself, and use that as well. And so then... into a separate bowl, you're going to whisk together, you can use a fork too, about 2 or 3 tablespoons of tomato paste with 1/4 cup of vegetable stock and 1 tablespoon of maple syrup. That's like a really nice balance to the tomato paste. It helps cut the acidity. And you're going to pour this mixture over your vegetables into the pan. And then you want to lightly massage the mushrooms and the onions and the peppers with the marinade. Use your fingers. If you're doing oyster mushrooms, you want to go very lightly because they can break apart very easily. But the portobellos or the shiitakes can handle a little more like roughness. Not too much roughness, but massage it in. And then you're going to throw that into an oven about 375 degrees Fahrenheit. Bake it uncovered for 20 minutes and let it sit there. After 20 minutes have gone by, check on it, and it should start to be like browning a little bit on the top and around the edges. Then you want to mix that around and throw it back in the oven for an additional 10 to 15 minutes. And what you're looking for are all of your vegetables to be kind of wilted and broken down. You want the mushrooms to be completely fork tender and to smell amazing as it's cooking there in the oven. I didn't say anything about salt because that's something that people have their own preferences, how much salt they want to add or not add. I would put in maybe like a tiny little sprinkle of salt.
It's roasted?
Before it's roasted, yeah. I should have said that earlier.
Well, we're going to take the... And we'll put that up on the Facebook page.
Yes, I typed it out.
There's an Eating It in the Hudson Valley Facebook page that I invite everyone to, what do they call it, like.
Yes.
Yes. Join it because I put things on there all the time, things that we don't even talk about here, and there's recipes, and of course the famous, by now famous, food report is on there every month.
Fantastic. And so this is really delicious on top of mashed potatoes or bean burgers. You could use it as a taco filling
I was going to say an omelet, but that's not vegan.
but you could, because I expect that everyone listening is vegan, so you can put it on top of your hamburger or into your omelet or over a salad even. Have it a little bit warm. Arugula is an amazing salad base because it's strong enough to handle like a little bit of a warm topping on top of it. It's delicious like that too.
Have you ever... taken just the shiitake mushrooms with a little bit of oil and roasted them till they're crispy and then grind them up and use that as a coating?
Ooh, that sounds amazing. I have not done that. I have roasted the shiitakes with a little olive oil, salt, and there's this ingredient called liquid smoke.
Yes.
And use it so sparingly.
That's sort of nasty, though, isn't it?
It makes me think of hot dogs. But if you used the tiniest drop of it in basically a full pan of mushrooms, yeah, and you roast them off, you get shiitake bacon.
Oh, right, right. Yeah. A little bit.
Just a little bit. Oh, a little maple, yeah, syrup in there, too, is really good.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah. I have a stovetop smoker.
Ooh.
I haven't used that. It takes wood chips.
Oh, nice.
And that would work in that.
Then you could
well
leave the
well
liquid smoke out
but
completely.
But using the shiitakes, the mm-hmm, crispy ground-up shiitakes as a coating for certain things, because I like it for chicken and things, uh-huh, but it would be good on coating.
Like tofu, a slice of tofu or tempeh.
Or tempeh, mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah. Bring that flavor, yeah, in. Yeah,
it sounds amazing. One. Yeah.
Well, maybe the next time I show up at the Garden Cafe,
it might be on the menu.
It might be on the menu. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I noticed also that Robichaud mentioned cauliflower couscous, and there's a cauliflower craze at the moment. I mean, people
sure
are using cauliflower. Mm-hmm. They're grinding it up like rice, and then they're making pizza crusts out of it.
They're cutting it into steaks.
Out of the stores like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not bizarre. Like it's not like the cauliflower that I've grown up with, which was like either frozen or I don't know, like, was it ever canned?
No, I don't know.
Just boiled into smithereens.
Boiled into submission.
The way that you famously did a cauliflower before is you boiled it, but you put a cheese sauce over it.
Oh, that's right.
That's how people use cauliflower, mm-hmm, and nobody liked it. Nobody wanted to eat it.
Probably
beat it cheese
probably
sauce.
Wasn't real cheese
it
sauce.
It was too. Yeah. I remember that from my childhood.
You do. The cheese sauce.
Boiled cauliflower,
yeah,
with cheese sauce.
That's ugh. It, right?
Oh, but at the farmer's market, cauliflower is also starting to show up.
Yes, yes it
and,
is.
In all and sorts of colors.
In all kinds of
all
colors.
All sorts of colors. And it's so pretty.
And it tastes
on the plate.
So so different than...
Well, roasting it is nice, too, with a little
nice
bit of red wine and garlic.
Ooh.
And a little olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you don't need the red wine for the colored ones, but the white ones you put in the red wine, and you get all this nice mottled mm-hmm redness over the cauliflower.
Oh, nice! That sounds great.
That's lovely. Well, we'll get back to some more recipes, and we will. Right. We'll be putting that recipe up. I am going to take the briefest break before we get to talk to Peter. Peter, we will. We've got a whole half an hour to talk about the book, so we'll do that. But right now, I want to mention something, and we could talk about this too, is music in restaurants. This is a topic that's come up, and the composer, if you've ever heard him, and I'm probably pronouncing his first name wrong, but I'll take I'll give it a shot. It's Ryuichi Sakamoto. It's Ryuichi Sakamoto. He's quite famous. And he created a playlist of music for the restaurant Kachitsu. And you can find the entire list on YouTube, and it's been posted on Eating It in the Facebook page. Do join the Facebook page, as I said before. And the food report is culled from various food and environment sites that give up-to-date information about agriculture, food, and environment, and more. Check it out. I do the work of saving you from reading tons of emails month to month and give you some of the essentials. So I am going to play one of the tunes that Sakamoto recommended for the and it is a tune by Bill Evans, by the Bill Evans Trio with Jeremy Steig, and it's a theme, it's a love theme from Sparta. Thank you. Listening to it here, didn't we?
It was beautiful.
It was a beautiful piece. And there's a lot more. You picked some good music. So now, Peter, tell us about this book.
Oh, you want to hear about the book?
Yeah, finally. Okay. Bountiful Empire.
I just realized.
And why I picked you.
Yeah, I understand. I just realized that there's no price in this book, so I can't tell people what it costs.
I think it's on the back. I think it's $45.
Do it anyway.
Oh, you can't do it. You're not allowed to do it.
Oh, really? Anyway, it's fairly expensive.
Yeah.
It's lavishly illustrated in color.
Mm-hmm.
It's big. It's printed on good paper.
Mm-hmm.
I presume this Priscilla Mary Isin is an American married to a Turkish person. That also seems to be the perspective that she's writing from. Now, you wanted to know why me.
Yes, why you?
Or you want me to explain that. I lived in Iran and India for 10 years, and I've visited Turkey many times. And I once lived several months in Istanbul.
Okay.
And I love Turkish food.
Yes.
I love the food of all those nations, and I would say that it is they are related cuisines,
mm-hmm.
Generally a sort of Central Asian tradition that spread through the whole area, Northern India. I wouldn't include South India in that. mm-hmm. in that category. Anyway, this book is not a cookbook, all right?
No.
It only has a few recipes in it, and they're very simple recipes, and some of them you couldn't do because you couldn't get the rare ingredients that are pretty much only available in Turkey. So even the recipes are just there for kind of interest rather than use. Mm-hmm. Some of them are okay. I mean, you know, like the recipe for pickled grapes, you could do that, for example.
Right.
Something I never had, by the way, so I'd like to try it.
Pickled grapes. It'd be sort of sweet and sour.
Yeah, it would be interesting.
Yeah. Well, give it to me. I'll try it.
Let's see. I made some notes about subjects that interested me a lot. The first one was fat-tailed sheep. A lot of Americans, I don't think, know what fat-tailed sheep are. Do you?
No.
Okay. They're a special breed of sheep that you get in those countries that has been bred over the centuries so that the tail gets fatter and fatter and fatter. The picture from the 18th century in the book shows a moderately fat tail. The ones that you see now are enormous. They must weigh about 50, 60 pounds.
Where do you see them?
Well, in fields where sheep are grazing.
Right. But in...
Well, yeah, I saw them mostly in western Iran.
Okay.
And obviously they have them in Turkey, too. I don't think I ever actually saw one in Turkey, but they're probably in eastern Turkey. Once I went to the sheep festival in Dutchess County, and I went into the hall where all the different kinds of sheep were, and there were no fat-tailed sheep. So I went up to the group of sheep herders who were talking at the end of the hall. I said, "Where are the fat-tailed sheep?" And they were like, "You know fat, you've seen fat-tailed sheep. Oh, tell us, what are they like?" They had never seen one.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're kind of rare. So the fat that comes from those tails is exquisite, uh-huh. Very, very saturated. One tablespoon of that fat in an enormous basin of rice flavors the whole thing with a kind of beautiful lamb chop flavor.
Mm. And is something like that described in the book?
No, she doesn't go into that much detail. I'm sorry.
Oh.
I happen to.
I mean, but does she mention the sheep in the book?
Yeah. There's a picture of a fat-tailed sheep.
Oh, okay.
And, she talks about something which the Turks call tarhana, and the Iranians call it kashk. It's a wonderful thing, and I've never, ever found it in the West. It's so simple. You take a sheep yogurt, and you put it in layers of... you hang it up in layers of cheesecloth, mm-hmm. and you let all the liquid drip out until it becomes like a hard crust.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Then you take that out and crush it up with olive oil and make a creamy sauce out of it. Mm-hmm. You put that on fried eggplant, for example. Kashkabanam jun. Oh, God, it's so good. The Turkish recipe is a little different.
Uh-huh.
They put some kind of thickener in it. I don't know why, because it works fine by itself. Anyway,
maybe they want to speed it up.
Maybe,
they don't want
it
to hang that long.
Yeah, it's labor intensive, but really worth it. You can put it on hot soup too. Fabulous.
I don't get where it's labor intensive because you've got.
Well, I mean, not labor intensive, but time intensive.
Oh, okay.
Now let's see. There's some delightful things in this book. It's really very good on the culture of food,
uh-huh.
and the history of food in the Ottoman Empire, which mostly in the latter part of the Ottoman Empire, because that's obviously where you get more information. Even printed cookbooks begin to appear, historians like Evlev Çelebi, who's a wonderful writer, mm-hmm. Orhan Pamuk discusses him in his charming book about Istanbul. It's called Istanbul. Mm-hmm. I recommend it. Mm. But I wanted to read this poem.
Oh, there's a poem in it, too?
Oh, wait a minute. I seem to have gotten the wrong page. Sorry.
That's all
right. There's a poem by Sultan Selim II, mm-hmm. which is an ode to cabbage, which I thought was very fun.
Nice.
I'll see if I can find it. Hey. Anyway, let's see. He has a section on the Imaret, which is a center for public hospitality supported by the state. Of course, they don't have these anymore. The modern Turkish state could never rise to this level of splendor. Mm. Everywhere, in every town, there was one of these imarets, or more than one. And it's a big public kitchen where poor people or anybody can go and have a nice meal at any time for free.
We need those.
We need those,
for free.
Yes.
Yeah.
The ancient Irish used to have these things, too, called hostels, they call it in translation. And I think many ancient civilizations used to have this. Mm. And we, of course, don't. Well, I suppose we do. We have soup kitchens and things like that.
That's not the same.
It's not quite the same.
No.
No. Also, the Sufis, the mystic orders, they also maintained public kitchens. So you could probably live pretty much for free.
And the Hare Krishnas, do they do that too?
Yeah, that's true. Hare Krishnas would be a modern equivalent of that. And sometimes they make pretty good food, I have to say.
Yeah.
If you like vegetarian food.
Yeah, they do.
Turkish,
we do.
Turkish,
we do. Some of us do.
Turkish cuisine is very strong on vegetables. And in fact, a lot of these dishes would probably qualify as vegan because they use olive oil for the for the oil, not butter. I mean, the Turks eat a lot of dairy products, but many of these dishes. And I used to eat in a restaurant for very poor working class people, where the hippies used to eat. We used to go there too. And there was a big pizza oven, and people from the neighborhood would make up their dishes and bring them there and pay a few pennies to the restaurant to cook their dish for them because they didn't have ovens in their homes. Mm. And they used to have these old wooden houses in Istanbul that were a terrible fire hazard, so they would prefer not to do any cooking in those houses. And the restaurant would cook for them. But the restaurant also cooked these dishes for the customers, and you could go into the kitchen and look at the dishes and say, I want some of that and some of that.
Yeah,
and some of that.
The Greeks did that too.
Yeah, yeah, the Greeks took up this custom, or maybe the custom came from Greece.
I was only in one restaurant. I think I told you about it before. It was called Jimmy's. It used to be downtown in Bowling Green in New York City. And you walk down. I think all the shipping magnates were eating there all the time. And you'd go into the kitchen and you'd point to what you wanted. There was no menu. And then there was a woman at the door, and you just told her how many plates you had, and she told you what you owed her.
Yeah, wow. That's right.
And I still remember the taste of that food.
it was delicious food.
It's delicious food. And those community ovens, too, that's in a lot of cultures.
Yeah.
You know, the Jews have that in Shabbos. You put the food in, and it's a slow cooked kind of thing, and you come back and you get your pot. Usually it's like a ceramic pot. Cooking in ceramic is also one of those wonderful things.
It's a beautiful thing, and it's so different too than fast food.
So a lot of nowadays you get a lot of eggplant, tomatoes, peppers. You get the stuffed things. Stuffed peppers.
The stuffed things. I love stuffed things. Do you ever do any stuffed vegetables?
Oh, I do. Stuffed tomatoes, stuffed mushrooms, stuffed peppers.
Yeah, they do all those things. Mm-hmm. And grape leaves.
I love that.
Oh,
and
nice.
Stuffed squashes of various kinds. Sometimes with meat, sometimes without.
Right.
Yeah. I do more stuffed things
towards poor people,
the fall.
Poor people in the East don't eat a lot of meat. Mm-hmm. And I would say there's a vegetable area that goes down also to Lebanon. Lebanese food is very strong on vegetables. Once you get to Iran, they're not so strong on vegetables there. They're very they're a richer country, or at least they were when I was there. And they love kebabs. So that's what you get in restaurants in Iran. Let's see. I'm so sorry I can't find this poem to
you. Can't find the poem. Is it in the index?
Well, I could spend some time looking, but I don't
want to. We could do that.
Then I can't.
Then you can't talk about the other things?
Then I can't. Anyway.
But I could give people a recipe while you look. How do you feel about that?
There's too many references in the index. I looked already.
Oh, okay.
I'll try later.
All right.
Anyway, take it from me that there's some charming things in this book.
Oh, good.
Anecdotes, little bits of poetry, and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Story about the cook of Jalaluddin Rumi.
What's that story?
Well, he became the second most important person in the Sufi order.
Uh-huh. The cook.
Oh, yes.
Good. Well, there are traditions where the cook, you know,
cooks are had a very high
Zen monasteries. They have the highest position,
high social position in Turkey.
Yeah.
In the court, also the cooks were people of power.
Uh-huh.
Especially the better the cook, the more power, of course.
Right.
Until you got to the head cook of the emperor. Who was like a prime minister practically.
Uh-huh.
I liked the page where she discusses how bread is holy in these cultures. It's true of all. I guess it's true of all Muslim cultures and probably of all Asian cultures. Bread is the Neolithic thing. You know, it's absolutely the staff of life, much more so than rice or any other grain. Bread, you can't eat without bread.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're walking along the street and you happen to see a crust of bread in the street, you have to pick it up, you have to kiss it,
mm-hmm.
well, or at least pretend to kiss it.
Right.
And then you have to put it like on a windowsill or someplace high up so that birds can eat it.
Ah.
And that gives it that then you're treating it like a blessing.
Right.
And you say a little prayer. Mm-hmm. You do not let bread fall to earth.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen hippies would let bread fall down and the Turks would get really angry.
Sure.
they thought that everybody understands that bread is holy.
Well, the sense of the sacred pervading things. I mean, we've lost a lot of that sense of the sacred.
Yeah. Well, food in general is a more sacred proposition in these cultures than it remains for us. Well, some Christians say grace before meals.
Yeah,
and that's the same kind of thing.
But that's not making the food sacred.
It's not so much making the food sacred as it is making your thanks to God for getting anything at all.
Right.
You know.
Right. I had this theory about saying grace or saying some prayer before eating. What happens is, you know, there are so many creatures living inside of our bodies mm-hmm. that when we actually say something about being grateful and then we eat it and we're feeding mm-hmm. these creatures, we forget mm-hmm. that this is going on inside of our bodies, this whole cosmos. And we're working so that we don't alienate them and we don't get sick in turn. You know, it's a cyclical event. What you put in your mouth and mm-hmm. what gets nourished. What we use as the term you or I is many, many things.
I found the poem.
Oh, good. See, I blabbered away.
Thank you. This Sultan Selim III, that's why I lost it. Oh. 1780 to 1807. And in this poem, he's saying, you know what halva is?
Halva?
Halva.
Yes. Oh, halva. Of course I know what halva is.
Right.
Oh,
yes. I guess everybody does.
Love
so, there's many different kinds of halva. Actually, the kind that we get is only one.
Right.
He declares that no halva party is complete without cabbage pickle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This reminds me of the people in Maine who tell me that when they make maple syrup, they have to eat dill pickles in between the tasting of the syrup, so the sweet and the sour. Mm-hmm. Okay, here's his poem. With the arrival of winter, the cabbage doth emerge, unafraid of cold, a noble vegetable, the cabbage, in shape and size like the mace of King Kay Kavus. Its leaves, like giant rose petals, nourish us. Unlike okra, threaded on a thousand threads, the cabbage may be compared to a lion riding in a carriage. With joy and pleasure, it is a perfect marriage. No halva party is complete without a cabbage. Ilhami sings its worth, and many praises, my dear cabbage, dear cabbage, dear cabbage. Let's see, King Kavus is a legendary monarch, and he carries a big mace, you know, a big cloak. Mm-hmm. Let's see, Ilhami is the pen name of the emperor. In the last line of the poem, you address yourself always. That's part of the rule of Eastern poetry. So any other problems in that poem? I don't think so. It's very clear.
Cabbage, so it's an ode to the cabbage.
Yeah, particularly
it's, and eating it with halva.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Cabbage pickle was traditionally served as a contrast to the sweetness of the halva.
So it's the contrast, the pickled grapes that you mentioned before.
Yeah.
The pickling of cabbage.
Yeah, they like
sour. There's also those nice turnips.
They love pickles. Also, in Iran, pickling is a great art, especially in Shiraz.
And
Shiraz is famous for its pickles.
And it functions as a digestive as well.
Yeah, it's good for you.
It's good for you,
that's
exactly.
Right.
It helps you.
They're great pictures in this book. There's a lot of paintings showing scenes with people eating.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, much more than I even knew, it's a favorite theme for art. And I particularly liked a calligraphic picture of a pitcher, a ewer, in other words, made out of letters, which is a special Turkish art. To make Arabic letters into pictures.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And this one on page 171, it's very beautiful, very beautiful. Then and then I'll just finish by saying there's a chapter on coffee, which is a fascinating story. There are whole books about the history of coffee in the Islamic world. It was discovered by Sufis in the Yemen because they saw goats eating the berries and then dancing. You know how goats dance.
Mm-hmm.
And the Sufi master says, take some of those beans and crush them up and make a hot drink.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can pray all night.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the origin of coffee. And it's quite late, actually. It's not discovered until the 13th century. And then it begins to spread around the Islamic world. And, of course, the clergy, since it's a Sufi thing, and the clergy hate the Sufis, so they hate coffee. And they say it's an intoxicating beverage, which, of course, is forbidden in Islam. And it is actually true that in Turkey, people were martyred for drinking coffee. They were executed. But they were so addicted to it that they didn't stop. And now, of course, Turkish coffee is famous. And a very, very good recipe for coffee. They figured out a very, very nice way to make it. And in the book, there's a picture of a beautiful coffee cup from the Ottoman period with a little box on the bottom of the cup with a lid, a little silver box. And in that box, you put ambergris.
Mm.
You know what ambergris
yes.
is?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You can keep on pouring cup after cup of coffee into that because the ambergris lasts a long time. They also used amber.
But where's the ambergris? The ambergris is at the bottom of the
cup. At the bottom of the cup in a little silver box with perforations.
Uh-huh.
So you pour the coffee in and a little bit of the ambergris seeps out into the coffee.
How does that enhance the coffee?
Oh, well, I never tried it because nowadays that cup of coffee would cost you like $100.
Yes, you can't find the ambergris.
I've never tried it.
Well, years ago at Kiehl's, I was able to smell ambergris.
Yeah, I have smelled ambergris.
Yeah, I remember that.
I have had, of course, coffee with cardamom. Cardamom is a very favorite flavoring for the coffee, and it makes it a wonderful addition.
Yeah. And then in New Orleans, of course, there's chicory, isn't it? That they put chicory in.
Chicory is a substitute for coffee, or you could make
half and half.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
I like it a lot. Actually, mm-hmm. chicory coffee is fine with hot milk and a beignet. You know what a beignet is?
Yes, oh, yes.
Are you from New Orleans?
I am not from New Orleans. I just love food.
We all do.
We all do.
Thank
you so much, Peter. We've got about 4 minutes left, and I want to put in some things about the food report. I do want to mention that about the Monsanto trial, and that it was the man at Johnson's was awarded $289 million in damages, and that kind of breaks open the possibilities for other people who want to sue Monsanto. However,
was that the Canadian farmer who was suing?
No. He was a garden. He took care of gardens. His name was Dwayne Lee Johnson, and he developed non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Oh.
And he used the Roundup.
From Roundup,
time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And people have been fighting that for a long time. And some people, there's a lot of people that say, oh, it's not science, it's not proven. I was on Facebook and I wandered into some group that way. I felt like I ended up in a foreign galaxy. Because I said, well, no, this was perfectly fine research. They showed it and everybody... it was just awful. I got out of there really fast. Facebook can be really scary.
It can be.
Because there are things that I think this was the genetic literacy project, you know, something, some highfalutin name like that. And maybe it's that and maybe it's not, you know, who knows. Mm-hmm. And also, what did I want to mention? Oh, there was a meeting yesterday in Albany. Hundreds of dairy farmers were gathered, and I haven't gotten a report about what that was about, but the dairy industry is having a big problem because the cost of milk is way down, and the farmers are going out of business and doing other terrible things and losing heart completely. So I'm hopeful to find a report on what that was. And hemp farmers are optimistic about their industry. And go to the food report, then I'll put it up online and you can read about that. And then New Orleans is experiencing two defining trends. People with a lot of disposable income have entered in, and prices are gone up, and people are being displaced, not just from that, but also from Airbnbs. And then the FDA is still trying to figure out what caused the deadly E. coli romaine lettuce outbreak that dragged on for months this spring and summer. And what they find could have big implications for the produce industry and how it coexists with animal agriculture. So there's information about that on there. And other things about ICE raids in Nebraska. And also I've heard about farms closing down locally because they have been raided and they have no workers. So it's... And then there's the problem with the EPA having been ordered to ban chlorpyrifos, which also was banned, but they brought back they said, oh, now it's okay. You know, we're not going to do what Obama said. And that is the end of our show. Thank you so much, Peter, for being here. And
my
Christine
pleasure.
For being here.
Thank you so much.
And I'm going to go out with our usual onion song just for a moment.
The world is just a great big onion, and hate and fear are the spices that make you cry. Oh, baby, and the only way to get